today for our podcast episode, we have Ted Cohen, who is artist development for Warner Brothers for a very long time. He had an epic episode on season one, and now we're in season two. He gets requested, like, when are we going to get another Ted Cohen episode? So here we are.
Yeah.
Welcome, Ted.
Great to be back. I wish I was there in person. Unfortunately, I can't be because of travel restrictions.
Corona.
This is a virtual hug.
Well, we feel it, man. And for our listeners, I wanted to say that Ted is our number two most downloaded podcast, only behind Alice Cooper. So obviously they like Ted, and we had to get him back, Fred.
And he's a rock star just like Alice.
Yeah, so there he is, man.
So Alice was the first, as you know, Alice was the first tour I ever went out on. Alice and Shep Gordon hold a special place in my heart in terms of just both being, you know, when the Supermensch movie came out about Shep, I went, it's absolutely accurate. Shep is the Supermensch, and Alice is right there with him. So I'm honored to be number two.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that about that movie, because I was always wondering if Hollywood kind of added a little bit of sizzle and glare to it, but you're saying it's pretty much right on the money, huh?
No, I think I said it last time. If I didn't, I'll repeat it. Shep Gordon ruined the rest of my life. I met him in 71 in Cincinnati at a place called the Carousel Inn by the Cincinnati Gardens, and I was in his hotel room, and I went, this is the smartest, nicest, coolest guy I ever met. And the reason I say he ruined my life was I expected all the other managers to be nice, smart, and cool.
Not
over
so
the
much.
Years, I met cool managers who were dumb. I met nice managers who were idiots. I met other, you know, jerks who were brilliant. But the Shep Gordon's combination of personal style and wisdom and sense of strategy and whatever, but he made you feel part of it. And I went, I never met anybody else, I don't think, that had the same combination that he had. And Alice, you know, was, you know, just the nicest artist to work with.
Still
not
is.
Not what most people expect, and he remains the same.
Yep. So listen, Teddy, we had a really wonderful, it was an epic interview, and we covered a lot of things on that last one, like Fleetwood Mac, like the Doobies, and maybe Angel. The Angel story might have been why it was so downloaded.
It might have been the Brian Ferry thing.
We talked about Prince coming over to your house.
Yeah.
We talked about Van Halen and Little Feat. So this time around, because you and I worked at Warner Brothers together, we had so many artists that now there's bands like Robert Palmer, ZZ Top, I'm just Pretender stories. I mean, I just want to start thinking about other stories you could tell us about those bands.
Robert Palmer, again, is near and dear. I mean, I still can't believe...
Let's go there.
So I worked with Robert on three tours. It was Double Fun? I'm trying to remember the album.
Double Fun.
Which album is this? Which one?
Yeah, it was probably Double Fun album.
Right.
But go ahead.
Anyway, he turned out to be the nicest human. Again, one of the nicest people I ever met. Brilliant musician, and as opposed to people who borrow from other artists and borrow from other genres and whatever, Robert immersed himself in it. So on one tour, the band was basically the Meters. It was...
From New Orleans.
From New Orleans, but it was one of the Neville brothers. It was Zigaboo Modalist. It was he basically, following the Sneak and Sally Through the Alley stuff, got very involved in New Orleans and that whole sound. So he basically worked with the band. When we were out together, when I was on the road with him, when I was honored to be on the road, we weren't out together. When I was on the road with him, he said, what do you like right now? And I told him that I was working with this other new group, the Pretenders, and I played him the first album. And he goes, can you introduce me to Chrissy? And so I connected him through Dave Hill, through their manager. Dave Hill hooked him up with Chrissy. They ended up collaborating.
Wow.
Some artists will, like, you know, I don't want to say steal, but they will borrow somebody's sound, or they'll borrow the influence. Robert would collaborate with them. Robert wanted to meet them. Robert wanted to co-write with them. You know, he heard the Gary Numan I Dream of Wires album, and Gary ended up producing the next album, which had, I'm trying to remember, I think it had Johnny and Mary on it.
That was a great song. That was a great album.
Right, and we're in New York. This was wonderful and horrible. Robert's playing at the Ritz in New York, which is now something Hall. I forget the name of it. It's over on 12th.
Town Hall.
Chris Blackwell was really against the pairing of Robert Palmer and Gary Numan, and I'm not sure it was the best pairing, but he was really against it. But Robert's playing New York. We're at the Ritz, and Chris is there up in the balcony, and he's got a table, and he's there for the whole show.
Well, let me interrupt. Let me interrupt real quick. For the listeners, Chris Blackwell was the president of Island Records.
He was the founder of Island Records,
which was
with artists such as U2,
Bob Marley.
Oh no, Pretenders was Sire. U2, Bob Marley,
Toots and the Maytals, Robert Palmer.
First of all, Steve Winwood. Most of the Jamaican bands, but later Robert and U2 and
Steve Winwood.
And so Chris Blackwell is the founder of Island. He's in Island at the time is being distributed by Warner. And the show's over, and I'm in the dressing room, and I said to Robert, I said, you know, Chris is out there. He goes, oh, I got to go see him. Robert walks out of the dressing room on the second floor, and it's on stage right, audience left. Chris's table is on the balcony right on the horseshoe on stage right, audience left. As Robert walks up, Chris gets up and walks out. So he waited for Robert to come out of the dressing room so he could walk out on him.
Wow, that's not nice.
Making the point that he didn't like, he still didn't like the album idea, even though people liked the album a lot.
So were you with him at all during the infamous girl band MTV video thing that really kind of put him out there as a household name?
Yes.
So when you guys were on tour, did you have the same girls? Because obviously the makeup job was the same. Was it a different girl every city, or how did that tour work out with the girls?
I was proud to be his wingman when we went out on nights when there were no shows.
Yeah.
You know.
That's funny.
The person he passed on was an 11.
Wow.
He held out for a 12.
and he could. He was so classy. He
Dapper.
Was such
he
a
was so
classy
nice
guy.
And so, but the thing that threw me about the whole thing was he always, he's very athletic on stage. He was jumping all over the place and very, you know, personable and motivated, and was always like in a tracksuit or in sweats or in whatever. The last time I got to see him was years later when he did the big band album on I think it was on EMI America. He did the crooner album, and he played at the Wiltern in L.A., and I went and saw him, went backstage and, you know, got a hug. And then a few months later, he died.
I know. It was just
unbelievable. And I didn't understand it to this day.
No.
Of anybody that I was, someone says, you know, of the artist you worked with, who would you predict, you know, would prematurely pass away? Robert Palmer.
I think he was 53. I mean, it
was very young.
Yeah.
And I thought he was in incredible health, and he died of a heart attack.
And one thing, another project he did with the Duran Duran Boys was the Power Station.
Power Station.
Man, I love that project, too.
I do, too.
Yeah.
But that was the thing. He was very much into collaboration. He was very much into it didn't have to be about him.
Right.
Good man.
You know, so that was wonderful. We did a live recording, and Fred remembers we did this thing called the Warner Brothers Music Show.
Which are brilliant albums. And I wish I had them all.
We used to do live recordings of artists, and in some cases, in the case of, like, Talking Heads, I called up King Biscuit and said, would you like Talking Heads? And they went, who are they? And I went, never mind, we'll do a Warner Music Show. So it was sort of our own version of King Biscuit.
Yeah.
Westwood One. We would do a live recording. And we recorded Robert in Boston at the Orpheum. And we called it Banned in Boston, you know, a play on words with everything that had been banned in Boston over the years. The show was amazing. And his sense of collaboration in terms of his, it really was a band when they were on stage. It wasn't his backing band.
Yeah.
Hey, are you in New York or are you in L.A.?
I'm in L.A.
Because I hear sirens, and that's more New York than L.A. Hey, let me switch gears now. ZZ Top, have you had a chance to see their documentary?
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God, Ted.
I have to tell you, when you mentioned ZZ Top,
you're going
to
love it.
I saw them on, you know, I saw them in Houston. I saw them in a few different cities.
Yeah.
But Larry Butler I had assigned ZZ to Larry. But I was friends with JW. I was friends with Bill Hamm.
Yeah.
We did, you know, on like big projects. When they went to Europe, I would work with them on planning what they were going to do over there. But at one point, somebody said to me, you know, who's your favorite manager? Who's your least favorite manager? And I said, well, my favorite manager is Bill Hamm.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, Dan, how are you? How you doing? Everything, whatever. And I said, my least favorite was a guy named Gary Kerfurst. And Gary managed Talking Heads.
Yeah.
And I forget who else he managed. He managed a bunch of bands. And, you know, I'd call Gary up and say, look, I've got this idea. I'd like Chris and Tina. And he'd go, no.
And I'd wow.
go, at least let me tell you what the idea is before you say no. And I said, the funny thing with Bill Hamm is I would call him up and I'd say, look, I got this idea for ZZ. And he'd go, Dad, I hear what you're saying. I think the guys are going to really like it, and I got to check their travel schedule because, you know, I don't know if they're going to have the time to do this, but I think they will be into it, but I'm not sure, but I'm going to get back to you on it, and I really like the idea, and I think the guys are going to like it, and we definitely want to do it, but we got to see if it's going to work. And I'd hang up with them, and somebody would say, did he say yes or no? And I go, I don't have a clue. But it was the nicest conversation ever.
Yeah. Well, you're going to...
You know,
well, you're going to love the documentary. It's on Netflix, and I think you're going to really enjoy it because they go back to the roots of that blues sound that they all three loved. They were listening to the same Mexican radio station that was playing the same stuff, and it's a wonderful, wonderful documentary. Lloyd, where should we switch to?
You want to talk about Pretenders?
Let's do some Pretenders.
Yeah.
I mean, Pretenders was great. I did the first two tours. Met them in New York. We went to Washington. In the case of Pretenders, I was overseeing this. At the time, I was overseeing this thing, the Warner Music Show. So I recorded them in Boston, Washington, and Philly, and then put together from the three recordings the best version of each. So it wasn't live from the Bijou or live from the Orpheum. It was basically Pretenders' East Coast tour. And the band was great. James Honeyman Scott and Pete Farndon, and I mean, they were just really great. She was amazing in terms of she would be difficult, difficult, difficult. I would be ready to go, look, you don't need me out here. She goes, you want to have dinner tonight? And then I would fall back into the fold. She would push, 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 and then she would hug.
See, and that's funny you say that because she always really pushed me, and I just couldn't get past that, you know? Yeah. So I never really had a relationship with her at all. John Honeyman Scott, actually on the very first tour, fell in love with a beautiful woman here in Austin, literally had a wonderful, gorgeous baby girl who's probably now in her 30s, if not, probably in her 30s. His ex-wife still lives here, and so does his daughter. I always thought Martin was probably one of the most underrated drummers. Just the way he attacked the drums and the way he held them down
very solid.
Yeah.
The thing that was sad about the band was, you know, James passed away.
Yeah.
They had a wake in London. They had a celebration. Pete went to the celebration, came home, and OD'd.
Oh, wow.
So Pete OD'd the night of James's wake celebration, whatever. And so the band kind of fell apart at that time. I ended up this was a few years later, I was partners with a guy named George Giz, who managed Mr. Mister and the Rembrandts.
Wow.
And I was basically renting office space from him, and he said, I want to manage a band with you. We put together this band called The Committee. It's Martin from The Pretenders. It's the bass player from The Fix. It was Phil Chen from Rod Stewart's band. It was, you know, not a super group, but a super musician group.
Yeah.
And George, you know, was riding the crest of Mr. Mister having, you know, take Broken Wings and Curie, and Rembrandts had a number one song with the Friends theme. And he says, we're going to do this huge showcase at Joe's Garage, which was Frank Zappa's rehearsal venue. And he said, we're going to get all the labels there, and we're going to close the deal in one night. And I said, coming from artist development at Warner, where we, you know, staged things where, you know, a club date and then a theater date and then a whatever, I said, why don't we just have them play FM station out in the valley, do a date, do a surprise date at the Whiskey and whatever, and then do the big showcase. He goes, nope. He says, this is the time. And I said, okay, fine. They had one really big show, and they choked.
Wow.
They literally got nervous, and the show was very, the music was good, but it was mechanical, and there were no offers from any label.
Huh.
And then George goes, well, let's do those gigs at those other clubs you talked about. And I went, I don't know, I think it's over. And everybody that, we, you know, the band basically went back their separate ways, and Martin eventually, you know, reconnected with Chrissy. But the band was amazing to work with. She was totally really about the fans. I remember we were at the Royal Oak in Detroit, and I had Dave DiMartino, who at the time was a stringer for Rolling Stone. And I said, I got Dave DiMartino here for your interview. And she went outside and sat outside with the fans for like 45 minutes. And I kept going, we've got Rolling Stone here.
You know, Ted, I was at that show, and that was an amazing show.
You were at the Royal Oak show.
Yeah, because that was my territory. But here's the crazy part, is that that band was amazing in the studio, but they really, really delivered it live as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, since we last spoke, David Lee Roth has done some of his Vegas solo shows. He just had to cancel some that were for March and parts of April due to the coronavirus. So some of the videos that I saw on the opening night were not that outstanding. So I was just kind of curious if you'd seen anything or talked to David, and what's the vibe on the solo shows?
Well, you know, I ended up in Vegas when he was doing it, and the day of the thing, this has got to be, let me see,
a couple months ago.
No, I know, but I'm trying to think. I was in Orlando for NARM years ago, and someone said to me, David Lee Roth is playing at the Hard Rock in Universal Orlando. And I went ahead. It was me and a couple other friends. I bought tickets, and I got there early, and I handed my card to a security guy on the door. I said, do me a favor. I know this, you get this all the time. Would you take this back to somebody with David and ask, you know, just tell him I'm outside. 2 minutes later, another guy comes to the door and says, David wants to see you. And so we all go backstage. And he was just wonderful. And the show was wonderful. And at the time, he says to me, you know, I'm rejoining the band. And I went, yeah, right. A few months later, it was announced that he was rejoining the band. So years later, I ended up in Vegas this past January, and he's playing that night, and I was going to repeat the whole thing about going to the show and whatever, but it was the same night. iHeart had a party, and I had my son with me, and he wanted to get into the iHeart party with friends, so I focused on that, and I said, I'll catch David somewhere else. So I didn't get to see the shows, but I read reviews. Some people said some nights he was brilliant, and some nights he was terrible.
That makes sense.
I don't know why there was the fluctuation in.
I think it's his voice, Teddy. I just think it's his voice. It's not about him as a showman. He's always been a showman. He just can't control a voice that's had a lot of miles and age. And
yeah.
Now, I know L.A. Lloyd and I, we started our whole podcast with Van Halen because that was my first day on the job, was the Blitz of the debut album. Is there a way with all your connections that you might be able to get at his camp and see if he'd like to do the podcast? Because we are flipping over to a radio show, and that'll be fun.
I would love to. I mean,
yeah, that'd be cool.
Figure out how to get a hold of him. I mean, I know how to do it. I just haven't bothered.
That'd be cool, though.
I got invited by a friend of mine from Universal to see the band with David and with Wolfie at the Hollywood Bowl. And we ended up with second row center seats, and I slid myself into the first row, and I literally was like a fanboy trying to get his attention, and it never happened. And I was like a rejected lover. I was like, this is, like, no, it's me right here. See me down here?
I know, that's what
and
happens.
I had gone early. It was part of this. The guy who took me to the show had bought the ridiculous VIP backstage experience, but the band never interacted with the audience at all. We got to sit at sound check. And okay. Even there, other than yelling out, Eddie, it's me, you know, I let it go.
Yeah. So you left not too long after I did. You left in 84, I left in 83. So you don't have any Red Hot Chili Pepper or REM, do you?
No.
Okay.
No.
So
the only thing I ended up people keep talking about webcasting and streaming and blah, blah, blah. In 99, to the two people in the world who could receive it, we did a live stream of Woodstock 99. And we hired this comedian that somebody had met named Patton Oswalt.
Yeah.
And he was our man in the field, and I was with him. And we were doing live streams from three of the stages. And we were also doing, you know, Patton out in the audience interviewing people.
Did you cover any of the fires and the mud?
So here's what happened. So yeah. The Sunday morning, Patton asked me, you know, are you going back to New York? I say, we're leaving tonight. He goes, can you drop me? I've got to fly out of Albany at 2 o'clock. Could you drop me in Albany? Could you leave early? So I left early, and we dropped him off in Albany at the airport, drove down to New York, checked into the hotel, turned on the news, and saw the stage was burning.
Wow.
But it wasn't a surprise because they were charging $10 for a bottle of water.
Yeah.
They held, you know, a peace, love, and whatever festival on an Air Force base, you know, on concrete runways. There was very little, you know, the grass areas were the strips between the runways. And it really wasn't, it wasn't peace, love, and whatever. We were on a decommissioned military base. So people were getting a little upset at what things were costing and how the whole thing was running, but I missed it. I knew it happened, but we had gotten out of there just before that. I had seen John Scherer, the promoter, earlier in the day, and you know, they were dealing with. Oh, there were a lot of egos at that one.
All right. Well, any crazy stories you want to tell us? I think Lloyd's got some questions to ask you real quick.
I got one more question about Prince for you. You know, obviously there's still stuff that's coming out, you know, stuff that the mysterious vault that's full of all these songs, you know, hundreds, thousands, we don't know.
Right.
In your personal opinion, what do you think we really actually have that we can still expect we've never heard before that is quality Prince that he would have said, yeah, this is okay for people to hear this?
Well, I don't know how much of this he recorded, but, you know, in the 4 or 5 years before he passed, he had become, you know, very involved with Jehovah's Witness.
Mm-hmm.
I think I told you what happened in Vegas. The guy I was talking to that said Prince came to the door as Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah.
And he told him, I'm not interested. And I said, did you realize it was Prince? He goes, yeah, I didn't like his music. And I'm like, I mean, so you didn't
it's
want
honest.
To be a Jehovah's Witness and you didn't like his music.
Yeah,
I said, can't you close the door on Prince? He goes, yeah, I knew it was. He had become very close with Chaka Khan and Larry Graham and a bunch of other musicians. And I imagine that there were a lot of, like, just messing around in the studio collaborations.
That'd be some cool stuff, some great, you know, core R&B.
You know, but probably not many people not remember, but know who Larry Graham is. But Larry Graham was the bass player in Sly and the Family Stone.
Yes.
And he was the one, he was the low voice. You're getting longer. I can't even do it. But he left and formed a band called Graham Central Station.
Yeah.
And they were on Warner. And manager was a doll. I can't remember her name. She's just a wonderful woman. And we're in Washington, D.C. And Larry decides to take the band and me and her to the Black Muslim restaurant in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And I joke, being a nice Jewish boy from Shaker Heights, I was terrified. The people were lovely. The food was delicious. I get a whole different perspective after that. Post that lunch,
yeah,
you know, I had a whole different outlook on, you know, what that was all about. And this was at the height of Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad and whatever. But the people were insanely courteous, and the food was brilliant. But Larry got, like I said, Larry and Chaka and a few others migrated up to Minneapolis and were like either living in the complex or just going back and forth. So I imagine there's a bunch of collaborations there. You know, I'm still working with Des on this documentary with Des Dickerson, which is Prince from high school up to Purple Rain.
Oh, wow.
Because Des was in his band from high school up to Purple Rain.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's talking about the early years. Since I saw you, I believe this was afterwards, we were Maggie and I were at a party at the Sunset Marquee here in Los Angeles, which is a, you know, not a hipster hotel, but a, you know, a high roller music hotel. And there's a guy there talking about Prince, and he's got a Prince T-shirt on. And I said to him, when he stopped talking, I said, "What do you do?" He goes, I'm producing the Prince documentary for Netflix."
Mm.
And I got all excited.
And he's a white guy. He's this young white guy, real nondescript, real easygoing, right, Ted?
But he's Dutch.
Okay, Dutch. Okay. Well, Dutch and white are same thing.
He's not producing the documentary. It turns out he's the archivist.
Oh.
I get him on the phone with Des, and Des realizes who he is, and he goes, "This guy's not the producer. This guy," he goes, "Well, it's my project." I go, "Yeah, and it's the project for the guy who's cleaning the office every night."
Yeah.
It was right. Like, I kept apologizing.
All right, Teddy, I don't mean to interrupt you, but we're rolling on some time here. But we had the opportunity of being in the music business at probably the pinnacle of the heyday of partying and hotel destruction and blow and God knows what all. You want to share maybe who the craziest band with the most blow, the craziest hotel destruction? Our listeners
the hotel's very easy. Remember the Whitehall in Houston?
Fuck yeah, I stayed there all the time.
Right. So first Van Halen or second Van Halen tour, we're staying. I think it was the second tour. We're staying at the Whitehall, and we started renting a separate room. There was basically a room that was the bar. And at the time, I think it was Harvey Schaps or it was Steve Vano, would have a big wad of cash. And when we checked out, we'd say, okay, one lamp, $30, one table, $100. And they basically paid the breakage in cash out of road money.
Yeah.
But every night there was some kind of damage. But as I told you with Van Halen, you know, my room went out the window the first night of the first tour. They threw all my furniture. And then when security came, they said, you know, "Who are you?" And they said, "We're Journey."
I love that story.
Oh, you appreciate this. So,
that's funny.
I ran into Steve Perry all the time at this restaurant in L.A. And we finally ended up sitting down one day, and he says, "I got to ask you." He says, "First of all, you were on the whole tour," because I ran into him like 7 years ago, and I said, "Hi," and he goes, "Warner Brothers guy, Van Halen." And I went, "What?" I had no idea he would, you know. And we would say hi. We would say, you know, "Hello, how you doing?" But this time we sat down. He goes, "I got to ask you a question." He goes, "You know, I was a sound engineer before I became Journey singer."
Wow.
And so I would go out with a baseball cap on and a jacket, and I would mix before the opening act sometimes if they didn't have their own sound guy. He says, I put limiters, compressors, whatever, on the opening acts to make them sound very flat. You guys were the only band who figured out how to get around it. How'd you do it? And I told him our sound guy was from the Whiskey, and he made a career out of screwing the opening acts. So
Peter,
he knew
Pete Angelus?
Well, no, Pete was the lighting guy.
Oh, okay.
Pete was lighting. I can't remember who the sound guy was. And there was Rudy and
oh, that's right, Greg. Rudy. I remember him.
Rudy and Greg.
Greg, yeah.
I think Rudy passed away. I think Greg's still alive, or Greg passed. One of the two of them has passed away. You know, I still talk to Kevin Dugan all the time, who's still with Michael Anthony for like almost 40 years now.
Man.
But Steve was talking about how Van Halen was able to upstage them every night, even though he would go out and basically doctor the board so they should sound bad.
They rose above it.
I mean, those kind of things are fun. I had become friends with Journey, even though they were in Columbia, and I was the Warner guy. And for Christmas one year, they sent me a Journey winter leather bomber jacket, like
nice.
You know, somebody would wear in World War II in a fighter plane. And a few weeks ago, I brought it over to the restaurant, and I gave it back to Steve and said, here, auction it for charity or whatever. I feel really weird. You know, I'm not going to ever wear it again, but I don't want to put it up on eBay or something.
How sweet is that?
So, you know, sign it, and, you know, if you have a charity that asks you for something, give them the jacket with, you know, sign it on there's a leather patch with the Escape logo on the front. And when I came back to the restaurant a couple weeks later, he had me sit down with a bunch of his friends to tell Van Halen stories to them. It was really... It was a lovely but strange moment.
I bet. All right, I got our closing question for you, Ted.
I'll give you a short answer.
No, you don't have to.
Answer.
But here's the deal. Again, back in our heyday, we didn't really know that blow was bad for you. It gave you energy. It smelt good. You know, we didn't really know. And
right.
Somehow our bands, Van Halen, Fleetwood Mac, Little Feat, and Lowell George. Who were the most abused? I think it's Fleetwood Mac, is my guess.
Fleetwood Mac, hands down.
hands down?
I mean, they had a concierge. I mean, they had a guy whose only job was to fill, you know, Heineken bottle caps.
Wow.
You know, if you look up a book, and I'll leave you with this. If you look up a book by a guy named Michael Chugg, the book's called, it's on Amazon, you can check. It's called Hey You in the Black T-Shirt, which is hilarious because it came out of him standing on stage in Sydney at a festival yelling, somebody was in a fight down in the audience, hey you in the black T-shirt. They were all in black T-shirts.
So, Ted, I got to tell you this story. I hitchhiked around
So what happened is, in the book, he talks about that Fleetwood Mac insisted on two cases of Heineken every night at every show. He would then go in the dressing room, and the beer was untouched, but the bottle caps were gone. And he couldn't figure out why. And then somebody whispered in his ear why, and what he couldn't understand is why didn't they just keep a bag of bottle caps instead of making the promoter buy a Heineken every night?
Yeah. Well, there you go. A lot of wasted Heineken. And
you were going to say something.
What happened is I hitchhiked around the country to get out of Detroit when I was like 18. And I end up in Scottsdale or Mesa outside of Phoenix. And they had this water park called Big Surf, which was a big wave that people could surf. And they would have bands play. And, of course, I'm hitchhiking, so I don't really know anybody except whoever I pal with. And Rod Stewart and Small Faces were playing, and I got up to the very front of the stage. It was outside Phoenix in the fall, so the weather was pleasant. Right. And Rod had this pile of blow on Ian McLaughlin's piano. And he'd go over and he'd have the back to the crowd. He'd do a huge, like, sniff and then spin to the right, back to the microphone. And I was right there. So I'm watching all the blow falling out of his nose. And he'd be back at it. And we did have Rod Stewart in our career, you and I.
Right.
But did he finally kind of say, hey, this probably isn't really good for
him? I never ran into that with him. What I got involved in at one point when Tonight's the Night was a big hit, you know, the Atlantic Crossing album.
Yeah.
We had him doing, you know, I say that my legacy to the music industry was I decided that the after show things were a disaster, and I moved them to before the show. So it was come backstage for 15 minutes. The tour manager brings Fleetwood or Rod Stewart or Asia into the room, and then he comes in 10 minutes later and goes, "Oh, guys, I know you're having a good time, but we got to go do a show. Sorry, go to your seats, everybody." Then there was no waiting in the hallway for a half an hour after the show while they fought or they drank or whatever they did.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
We had Rod doing, you know, meet and greets. And I had to say to him one day, I said, you know, people think that artists are, you know, elegant and mysterious, and there's this layer of, you know, mystery around them. We had him. We were in Minneapolis. He's talking with the head of music at Best Buy, and he says, "So how many of my albums have you sold?" And they said, like, I don't know, 15,000. And he goes, "Is that all? You can't do better than that?" I said, "Well, we've decided in your case we want to keep the air of mystery around you. We're not bringing anybody backstage anymore."
You're cut off. Thanks, Teddy. Tell Maggie I said hello. And
hi, Maggie.
And as usual, we love you and thank you for coming on the Promotion Man podcast show. And call David Lee Roth's camp.
Have a great one there, and I hope everybody in Austin is safe.
Thank you. And call David Lee's camp, and let's get an interview with him.
You got it.
Thanks, bro.
Much love. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Thanks, man.